Hello and welcome to the Commentator's Curse. My name's Ian Danter. For just over 20 years now, I've been working as a football commentator on both local and then national radio. And in every press box I go to, I bump into people who do exactly the same job as me, only entirely different. And it's a weird, weird world that we commentators inhabit. So the whole idea of this show is to kind of lift the lid a little bit onto how people got into the industry and frankly, how they've stayed there and how they intend to stay there as much as anything else, because we've all had very different ways of finding a way into this game, as I will be testament to, because I've probably got one of the weirdest routes of all. Anyway, enough of my yakking, but there's five episodes in our archive that you can check out, starting with Guy Mowbray and Ian Crocker in episode one through to episode five, which was Ian Dennis and Clive Tildesley. And you'll find those where you found this podcast. But let's get on with episode six, and I welcome my two guests for today's Commentator's Curse. First of all, a man who's been working for Sky now for around about 15 years, I think, on and off. Cut his teeth in local radio on Merseyside. But he's, I kind of think he's one of Sky's secret weapons. Daniel Mann from Sky Sports is with us on the Commentator's Curse. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there. I've been described as many things. A secret weapon is a first, but it's nice to be here.
Stick it on your CV. You know it,
mate. I will do.
And also with us on the Commentator's Curse, a colleague of mine at TalkSport. He's been a colleague of mine for over 10 years now because he joined after the 2010 World Cup in South Africa. But you'll know him just as well as the new voice of England commentaries on ITV plus much more beside. Sam Matterface is another of our guests here on the Commentator's Curse. Hello, Sam.
Hello, how are you? I'm delighted to be in the Arsenal with a secret weapon.
you're no secret, Sam. You see, I could call you a secret weapon, but frankly, when you're on the when you're on national television, the secret's out. I'm sorry, I can't call you that anymore.
I haven't been a secret ever since I picked up the Dancing on Ice microphone.
Well, we may just get to that. That may well come up, but I wanted to start by saying you are showing us all up, Sam Matterface, from last night alone, because you went to the Manchester United West Ham game to commentate on it for TalkSport, yeah. And you went green. You went on your bike.
I did.
This is extraordinary, because I've never, ever gone to a match anything other than in a car, maybe on a train once or twice, but you went in your little bicyclette.
I did. And do you know what? I'm going to try and make out that it's all to do with the fact that I took inspiration with Dan and his employers and their zero carbon game that they did on Sunday. It's absolutely nothing to do with that. So don't give me too many plaudits. It's basically because I found out that Radio 5 Live were doing the post-match, which meant that I was finished on the full-time whistle. And I thought to myself, if I take the bike, because I only live 15, 20 minutes on the bike from Old Trafford, I can get back in time to have a little bevy in the local pub on the way home. So that was my motivation. So forget all this green stuff. That was all nonsense. It was just so I could get back before closing time.
And you did, I presume?
20 past 10, yeah.
Oh, good work. Good work. So you could sink at least two in that time before the bell rings. Excellent work. Dan, I don't know whether you've ever gone to a game on anything other than a car or public transport.
No, afraid not. I don't have a bike. I would love to have a bike, but I don't live near enough to anywhere to really use it for a match, I'm afraid.
And presumably, Sam, you weren't riding in too much of haste on your way there, so that you weren't sitting there humming next to Andy Tennant Durham for 2.5 hours.
It's funny you should say that, actually. I did take my time for that reason. So I had a leisurely sort of a leisurely jaunt across the Fallowfield Loop and down through Chorlton and into Stretford before I turned up at Old Trafford. Yeah, so I did take my time because I was a bit concerned about that.
It was quite
a mild summer evening as well last night.
Yeah, it was very nice. Well, press boxes are notoriously, you know, tight, cramped spaces, and Manchester United, let's face it, is one of the most tight and compact of all.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure that's a remnant of Sir Alex Ferguson not liking the media at all and making that media working space as uncomfortable as humanly possible.
It's a great advert for trying to keep fit, because the smaller you are, the slimmer you are, the more comfortable you are at Manchester United. It is absolutely horrendous. I remember once actually sitting in between Danny Kelly and Stan Collymore doing a commentary on Manchester United versus Rangers. That was an experience.
Yeah, the meat in the sandwich, yeah, that you don't particularly want to be. Unless, of course, you're vegan. Who knows? But you're mostly on gantries, Dan, rather than sort of radio commentary positions that we have. So life is a little easier, but then you still have ladders to negotiate sometimes.
Oh, yeah, fun and games with the ladders. Birmingham City, as you will know extremely well, that is the infamous one where the ladder used to disappear, never to return, half an hour before kickoff. So, yes, you had to take care of certain matters well and truly before. And sometimes you had an issue with that that needed to be suddenly dealt with, and other items needed to be pressed into service, if I can be as discreet as possible about that.
Are we talking empty bottles?
Swiftly filled bottles, yeah, is what we're talking, yeah, and whatever else might be to hand.
Good grief. I do remember Pat Murphy from the BBC actually taking legal action because of that gantry, because he fell off, because there was a time when all the radio guys were up there too at St Andrews, up on that gantry. So we all had to make sure our ablutions were in order, just like you were. But Pat was making his way down, I think, with his broadcast kit, and slipped and fell off the last two or three rungs of the ladder. And successfully, I think, obtained a sum of money from the club because there weren't enough health and safety notices.
Yeah.
Around.
Well, I am pleased to say that the ladder does come down on request now. So that particular issue has been addressed, but the view hasn't. It can be quite difficult with the odd bit of scaffolding that suddenly appears in the way. My issue with it is that they did actually rebuild it about 5 years ago, but they rebuilt it exactly the same as it was before. So not solved any of the issues at all.
That's the main stand at St Andrews for you. It's been there since 1954, and all they've ever done is just a lick of paint here and every couple of years, and some new wood paneling in the
some fresh planks, and
fresh plank,
new screws maybe,
and be happy with that. Yeah,
yeah. Get on with it.
You get to go up gantries as well now and again, don't you, Sam? Because of course you do TV, you know, obviously with England and stuff, but Wembley's a much more pleasant experience as a TV match commentator, isn't it, than a St Andrews?
Yeah, I did my first ever TV commentary, live TV commentary for ITV at Birmingham, at St Andrews, on that gantry. I think it was Birmingham against Club Brugge in the Europa League on a Thursday night. And I think Birmingham came from a goal down to win 2-1, didn't they, with a late penalty, if I remember rightly.
Correct.
Look, I'm lucky enough to do a sort of mix and match now between TV and radio, and as a result of that, I've been to quite a few television gantries. I was on the Old Trafford gantry the other week for the I've been on the Old Trafford gantry recently. That wasn't for Soccer Aid, that was something completely different, but I was on the Etihad gantry for Soccer Aid the other week. And I don't know about you, Dan, I don't know how many you've done up there, but that's really tight, isn't it? That sort of you're right in the first row of the crowd. So
yeah,
I had Ian Sterling with me, and he's quite famous, and everybody around us just spent the whole evening tapping him on the shoulder and asking him for a selfie.
Well, no, I've had the Etihad reminds me, I once was doing a game there with Gary Birtles, and because of where the monitors had been put, we had to keep leaning over. And of course, you're right in front of, so you could see the near side of the pitch. So we had to get that sorted in the end, largely because we were leaning forward, and we were blocking people's views. So I got a clout round the back of the head about 20 minutes into the game from some irate City fan, because I was getting in the way of his view of the game, which I suppose is fair enough. But we managed to get it sorted there for that reason. But yeah,
really,
you're
close.
Right. You're right in there. It's you know, you really do feel like you're very much part of the crowd at that one. There's also the higher one, which I sometimes used to go on in the glory days of 3D, when we used to do that. So you'd have the main commentators down on there and we'd be right up top. But that, regardless of whether it was August or January, you were like, it was like Ice Station Zebra. You were in this kind of wind tunnel, and it seemed like there was a 60 mile an hour gale every time you're up there. And my notes blew away once when I was up there. So I've had some interesting experiences at the Etihad in that respect, yeah.
What did you do when your notes disappeared off into the ether?
Well, all you can do, well, the point of doing the notes essentially is so most of it lodges in your brain, isn't it? Yeah. So fortunately, most of it had that particular day. I think it was they're playing Spurs in the Premier League. And yes, I just remembered what I remembered.
I had a similar experience at Anfield when the gantry was on the other side, when they were rebuilt, it was before they were rebuilding the main stand. And I remember Stan and I being right up at the top. And I had these handwritten notes of Manchester City, and I think it was Anfield, so it was Liverpool. And I for some reason, they were on the edge of the desk, and a gust of wind came, blew them. And I saw them sailing down onto the pitch, just flailing slowly. I was thinking, there's no way, because when you're in that gantry, you've come up again, a ladder, over the roof, walked down across an Indiana Jones rope bridge, got into the gantry position. You ain't going anywhere. You're not going anywhere after that. So they were just settling onto the pitch. And Brian Kidd noticed them, ran over, picked them up. And I was watching it. By this point, it was now just a fascinating thing to watch. He picked them up, looked at them, looked over at the Liverpool sort of coaching staff and where they were getting ready. They were warming up. And then looked back at his own team and then called over one of the other coaches and went, look at this. And he thought it was some sort of crib sheet that they'd left on the ground. It wasn't. It was just my crap notes.
Early Spygate. Yeah. Pre-Bielsa Lampard. Brilliant. Well, let's go back to the start, gents, if I may, because I always try and do that with all my guests on the commentators. Because Daniel, I'll start with you because I'm not sure whether the information I have is correct, but was your start in broadcasting at Radio City on Merseyside?
Yes, absolutely. That's where I got my first experience. I wrote to Clive Tilsley, who was a legendary figure at Radio City, was the sports editor for many years, as you'll know. And he helped me out with a phone number for his old mate who was in charge of the sports department at that point. And I rang him up and invited me in for work experience. And it kind of went from there.
What year?
What year? Oh, 99. I was at university doing a radio production degree, which was very useful because it told me all the practical bits and bobs. And I was able to do a sports show. And thanks to my connections, that albeit tenuous at that stage at Radio City, I went to do a commentary, or was going to do a commentary on a reserve game at Everton, and ended up doing a commentary in my bedroom on a Tranmere game that was on the telly down the phone with a bit of, if you have a surround sound amplifier, you can get the crowd through the back speakers. So if you turn off the front speakers, you just get the crowd through the back. So kind of made it sound as though we were at the ground. The only problem was the game we were watching was on Sky. So you had all these lovely crowd effects, and with the replays and everything, every so often in the background, you just hear, which kind of gave the game away. But I did a commentary on that, and I was doing work experience at the time, and I submitted it on mini disc to the powers that be. And one weekend, my now Sky colleague, Vinnie O'Connor, was off snowboarding. He was the Tranmere man, and I got to report on a Tranmere game on the strength of that. And that's where it all kind of really began. I was still at university then, so started doing a few games for Radio City, and then I got a job in the newsroom just because I'd been hanging around for so long, really. And they took pity on me, I think.
So who was your mentor? Was there anybody in those early years who kind of took you under his or her wing?
Yes, I mean, there were two very important people at Radio City. I mean, Clive Tilsley had already been a kind of someone I wrote to when I was very young, for advice on what to do and how to proceed. But the two people at Radio City who, one of whom's no longer with us, I'm afraid, Phil Easton, who was a very big radio figure on Merseyside. He used to be the on-pitch announcer at Anfield, and he passed away too young, 11, 12 years ago. And he was great with me. I worked on his breakfast show. He taught me a lot about broadcasting and sort of connecting with an audience. And there's a guy who's never talked about, who worked for Radio City for many, many years, sports producer called Steve Kelly, who worked with
Clive Tilsley, Richard Keys, Elton Wellesby, Kevin Keatings, Graham Beekhoff, Gary Bloom, all these people. He worked with Pete Waterman on a legendary radio show, was a big, big friend of his. And yeah, he was a massive figure, you know, going through the commentaries in the early days and pointing me in the right direction, talking about production, how, what sort of approach to take. And he's no longer in the industry, and a great loss to the industry, I think. But he was a fantastic figure for me and a great help.
It's funny, isn't it, Sam? You know, it's not just necessarily about the people who are your immediate bosses, but sometimes it's the people, the unseen, the unheard, that can be just as crucial to somebody's development in this game.
Yeah, and the best encouragement I ever got was from Ian Dark and Martin Tyler. They were the two people that had sort of helped me and pushed me in the right direction. Ian Dark was fantastic for me because I was working in Portsmouth, and Dark is a massive Portsmouth fan. So he would pay sort of more attention than maybe a normal person would because of that. So he would listen to tapes of mine, and you know, I'm going back a long time now, actual cassettes, where he would
remember listen, those.
He would listen to commentaries of me, and then he would, you know, tell me, right, try this, try that, go to this person, go to that person. So he was great to me, and you know that, and no one would ever know that, but he was incredibly generous with his time, and that helped me no end really, because it gave me the confidence to keep pursuing it. Because I think, you know, and Dan will sort of say, you know, especially when we were doing local radio, and we were doing local radio at a similar sort of time, it was collapsing all around our ears. Commercial radio was collapsing around our ears at that level, at the local level. We knew what was coming because we could see it from the inside in. As businesses, we were struggling. And we were all doing 12 jobs. So I was the breakfast show host, the program controller, the sports editor. And I know that, you know, my station was a lot smaller than Dan's, but it was a similar sort of feel everywhere, in that, you know, the people that were doing the breakfast show were also in charge or were coaching other people. It was a very small staffed operation. So, you know, you were sort of panicking about what you would do next. And it was only really sort of the confidence that I was given by Ian and Martin that I kept going at it, really.
Well, that reminds me of a time we used to cover the Grand National Radio City. Obviously, it was a massive, massive event for us every year at Aintree. And I remember going out to the pub near the station on maybe the Thursday night before the Grand National, and Cornelius Lysett was there from Five Live. The producer who was working with him used to be at Radio City. So we were all out for a drink. And Cornelius said to me at one stage, what's the size of your team, you know, producing the Grand National back there? And I just said, well, you're looking at it.
That is what it's like in commercial radio. You know, it is just a one-man band, maybe two if you're really lucky.
Well, I did have some sterling help from chap called Carlos, who's still working on the radio in Merseyside. So it wasn't quite true, but just kind of making a point. There was literally I was at the desk presenting, kind of producing, and there was another guy sort of editing stuff as necessary, and that was it.
I always find it kind of odd, because it always seemed to me, it depends on the territory, of course. Some areas of the country were different to others, but live football on independent local radio could be a profitable exercise if it was handled and negotiated in the right way. I think maybe ILR became a victim of its own success, and that it started bidding more and more and more to keep the momentum it had actually got during the 1990s. Is that a fair comment?
I think, and I was lucky enough to work for Capital Gold Sport at the end of the 90s, and Jonathan Pierce just before he'd gone, well, for a couple of years before he went to Five Live. And I think they did an unbelievable job. When I was growing up during the 90s, the late 80s and 90s, they were the place to listen to live football in London. I mean, it was a cult show, Capital Gold Sport. I know that, Dan, you became part of that network, and there was all of us sort of satellite different places where we'd all join up and do the sports show from wherever there happened to be live football, and Jonathan Pierce was very much sort of the leader of that, the driver of that. But There was, and I don't know what the figures are. I just know that it became ridiculously expensive to the point where Arsenal were charging so much money for their live commentary rights that it became cost prohibitive. I mean, it was something like £500,000 or something. And there's no way that a commercial radio station with the income that it generates is going to be able to pay that sort of money on a season by season basis to get the rights to 38 football matches. It's just not going to happen. I mean, I was involved in the negotiations. In fact, I helped write a contract for negotiations in Portsmouth for our third contract that we did with the football club. And the money was ridiculous. And we could only afford it if it was the only thing we really spent any money on. And I think we got to a point where we once had a month where we broke even, and we were delighted about that. You know, it became at the early part of the 2000s. Don't ask me why. I mean, if you speak to Richard Parker, who is the legendary controller of Capital in the 90s and then now Global, he will probably tell you in quite a stern Scottish voice it's something to do with the BBC. But he used to say that about everything. So, I think it's something to do with the fact that the amount of money that was spent on radio rights just became unpalatable for anybody who was trying to make a business out of commercial radio.
Richard Park, for those who aren't aware, if you remember Fame Academy on the BBC, he became notorious as the judge that took on Patrick Keelty.
The headmaster. He was the headmaster of Fame Academy, wasn't he?
He was. But as a football rights bidder, he was incredibly, incredibly tough. And maybe Capital Radio became a victim of its own success because of that initial desire to take on the BBC. But Radio City, was it kind of that was a separate entity to the Capital Group, wasn't it, Daniel?
Yeah, we were in opposition. We were, you know, when Century in Manchester came and parked their tanks on our lawn and actually very briefly stole the, they bid for it, obviously, and it got the Everton rights away from us.
Stole is fine.
Everton actually intervened and blocked that deal, and we ended up getting the rights back, even though we bid less money, which was interesting. So we had all that to deal with. There was competition between commercial stations, and that got quite, not in terms of interpersonally between the guys, but it got quite heated and quite difficult at certain levels about what audio you're allowed, who you can speak to, and things like that. So that was quite a time. I remember Century outbidding us for a European tie. Liverpool had at Olympiacos. And, you know, this would be something that some of you are familiar with, the concept of unofficial commentary. We just did it anyway. And I remember getting a tape of commentary effects that had fireworks on it when a goal went in and all this. And I went home in a taxi and the cabbie said, "Oh, did you hear the game on?" He had no idea who it was, obviously. "Did you hear the game on Radio City tonight? What an atmosphere that was." And Century were there. And I don't think they quite got the same level of hostility in their atmosphere that we had in ours. But we just did it. I mean, they bid a five-figure sum, I think, for one game, yeah. Which that was just ridiculous. We couldn't compete with that.
Isn't it? I mean, that's happened in European games. Actually, it was happening even recently in European games. I'm pleased to say it looks like that has started to come down. But ultimately, the idea of a radio station, even a station like TalkSport, bidding a five-figure sum for one individual radio commentary is, quite frankly, it's bonkers. I mean, why would you do it? As someone who did work as a program controller, I would never, ever sanction that because it's just pointless. The audience that you're going to get from it, it does not equate to the commercial revenue you're going to take. You just put yourself in peril.
Sam, let me go back to the beginning with you because, as I mentioned at the start of every episode, everybody has a different route into the career that we're all now in. But I guess it's fair to say that your route might be considered by somebody from the outside as one of the more conventional routes in that you started in hospital radio, didn't you?
Yeah, I've got, I mean, if you ever say to anybody, how do you get started in radio? Most people, especially when I was growing up, was hospital radio. And I was lucky that my hospital radio station was so, so good, but yet listened to by absolutely nobody, that I had basic, I had brilliant training. I was so lucky. I went at 14 years of age. I was sitting on the sofa being a layabout teenager. And my mum had said, you need to start thinking about what you're going to do. She was giving me jip about something. I was obviously a teenager, so I wasn't interested in what she was saying. And they just started Radio 5. It wasn't 5 Live as it is now. They just started Radio 5 as a, it was a children's and sports channel, I think. I think when they first started it or something, if I remember rightly. And Simon Parkin was doing a tour around the new Radio 5 studios on Live and Kicking, going, whatever it was at the time. They'd gone into this little segment and that's what they were showing. And I just went, that's what I'm going to do, to my mum. At which point she jumped over the sofa, whacked me on the legs and said, you're not going to do it sitting there, are you? Get up and go down to the hospital radio and try and get yourself involved then. And I was like, oh, all right then. And I did. And I was 14 years of age and I went down and I met some great people. I met James Desborough, who ended up being the Hollywood reporter for the News of the World. I met a guy called Steve Jones, who still works now in television production at ITV, or I've kept in touch with, what, 30 years or more. Harvey Cook, who has been a news reader on Radio 2, Radio 4, Radio 5, as well as hosting his own shows on Radio Kent. I met all these people that were literally doing the same as I did. They were a lot older than me, but I was just part of their gang, and I watched them. And for a year, I don't think I touched a single button or even spoke into a microphone, but I watched. And I was, you know, I gave up doing a lot of things that normal teenagers do on a Sunday in order to sit and watch and sit in that little rubbishy little studio. And then I got my hands on the keys and I became, I mean, it became whatever thing I did every day. I used to go in there on my own, open it up, turn it on. And I used to do it after school every day. My parents didn't really know that that's what I was doing, or I would dip in when I wasn't supposed to. And I just got used to playing with the buttons.
What did they think you were doing?
Well, both my parents worked, so they didn't come in till 6 or 7 o'clock at night. So I finished school at 3:30 and I'd go straight down to the radio station. I had the key. So I just went in there after school and just go in there and start playing. And I did. I got on as a result of that, I got on commercial radio as a DJ at 16, RTM. I got fired very quickly. Because I forgot to pull a mic fader down. I was having a conversation on mic. So my radio career didn't start off particularly well in the commercial field. And then, yeah, just sort of freelancing, really. And then after that, got a job eventually. Took a while, though. I think from the first day that I walked into that radio station, would have been November 92, I first got paid $2,000.
Okay, I don't feel so bad now, because the first year I worked for Tom doing comedy sketches, I didn't get paid for about 6 months, and I thought that was a long time. So 8 years by comparison is pretty good, Sam, I'll give you that. But with you, Dan, you've had a really good run at Sky Sports as a commentator, because your move from radio to television was mid-2000s, was it, when you first moved to Sky?
Yeah, it was a gradual process, really. I started doing the commentaries on Radio City, 20 years ago? And from there, you sort of becoming known in the area, you pick up other things. And both clubs were sort of doing Everton Liverpool, doing a TV operation of sorts. So I started doing television commentary for Everton, just for the lounges, and then for a program that they did, put out overseas. And the same for Liverpool as well. So I got into television whilst still at Radio City, and I started sending the odd demo here and there. I got a nibble from Match of the Day first, and a guy called Paul Armstrong, who was in charge of that program, got back to me and said, get in touch around the autumn time and we'll definitely have something for you over the Christmas period. And then sadly he wasn't well and he wasn't there when I got in touch, and so the Match of the Day thing fizzled out. And then the following summer, I'd actually been taken off commentaries at Radio City in 2005 because what happened was they decided, there were three of us doing commentaries, they decided they wanted a Liverpool guy and an Everton guy. And Steve Hothersall was the boss, who you'll know now working at TalkSport, and he had just commentated on Liverpool in the 2005 Champions League final, and he clearly had become associated with Liverpool. So he took the Liverpool job. I was given the Everton job, but then they realised, because the two of us worked in the newsroom as well, and we would need some time, you know, to live. Then it meant that we would both be out of the newsroom for half the week. And then you've got a team of six and you're suddenly down to, you know, two thirds of that for most of the time. And it wasn't workable. So Alan Irwin, who was also doing games freelance and now works for Sky Sports News, he took the Everton role, and I basically ended up with nothing. So apart from filling in when one of them couldn't do it. And I wanted to commentate. I mean, I worked in the newsroom and I enjoyed that. I covered lots of amazing stuff, general elections, did lots of celebrity interviews. I was the deputy showbiz correspondent, Radio City. That meant I did it when the person who usually did it was off. interviewing all kinds of people from Sam Neill to Gary Wilmot. And that was fun. But I really wanted to get seriously into television commentary. It was what I always wanted to do. So my timing was obviously good. I've been doing these Liverpool commentaries, and I got a DVD of a Merseyside derby, which was pretty dramatic. Steven Gerrard got sent off, I remember. And so I ran off a load of DVDs over the weekend. I posted them out on Monday morning to everybody. By Tuesday afternoon, I had an email from Andy Melvin at Sky, saying, oh, I like your style, we'd like to get you in. By the Wednesday, I'd been booked for two games at Sky. And then that same week, I got a response from Eurosport, went to see Simon Reid at Eurosport. I got a response from fine ITV commentator of your Jerry Harrison, who was big executive at what is now IMG. Got a response from him, was booked for a game by the end of the week. So it all happened gradually, but suddenly. But I think my timing was particularly good because I think Ian Crocker and Jim Proudfoot had both left Sky that summer or were in the process of doing so. And so they needed a couple of voices. And I was lucky enough to be one of those.
What a week. You must have drunk that week. I would have. I'd have been straight down the boozer to celebrate that week. Goodness me. There's some big names there. I mean, Simon Reid, who was one of the first voices of Channel 4 Sport with basketball. And Jerry, as you mentioned, ITV Anglia's, he was the Ipswich Town Norwich.
Absolutely.
When I was a little boy.
Yeah, fantastic, fantastic broadcaster. And he actually had a Merseyside link because he was on Radio Merseyside in his early days. So he was quite receptive. And he in my early days of commentary, was one of those people who... I didn't ask him for advice, but he listened to a few of the things I'd done and suggested a few things to try, which I very quickly incorporated. And so he was a fantastic, from everyone who I know who worked for him, he was a fantastic boss, as well as a great broadcaster.
So for Sam, much like with Ian Dart with you then, Sam, in terms of the, you know, notes, as it were, on what you were doing in your early days, was there anybody else who fitted that bill?
Oh, I mean, I've been lucky enough to get advice off everybody. I mean, Clive Tildesley once wrote me a 3-page email telling me what I needed to improve on after a television game at Stamford Bridge. I did Chelsea versus Brentford. And I'd asked him, I said to him, look, if you get a chance, can you sort of give me a hand and just make sure, because I was making the transition at that point. I mean, that was 2014. I've been doing it 3 years, but I was still felt I was very much making the transition from TV to from radio to TV. And I obviously still split my time doing that now. But he went through it with a fine tooth comb. And he is, if you ask him to do that, he will go through it and he will ruthlessly tell you what you're doing wrong and where you could have done this and where you could have done that. And he came up with a couple of really key things for me that had basically changed the way I prepare for a football match. with one email. He literally changed the way I prepare for football matches as a result of that. And it was all about the... I worked with Ed Chamberlain at Sky when I was doing Sky Sports News. And he was brilliant as well about, you know, identifying what's going to be on the back page tomorrow. Make sure you've got an idea, a picture in your mind that whatever story you're covering, whatever commentary you're doing, what is going to be the back page? When you close your game or you are headlining something that's happening during the match, think about what's going to be the talking point tomorrow morning. And that was helpful to me as well. You know, and then just constructing the way you do a commentary. A commentary has to have a narrative. It has to have a beginning. It has to have a middle. It has to have an end. You can't always control it. But what you can do is make sure you are across what it should be and spot the narrative whilst it's happening. And all that sort of play was very helpful from both of those two people. I worked with a guy. I did this weird foray where, like, a bit like Dan, actually, you know, one day someone asked me to go and do something. I did it. The next day I seemed to be working there, and that was Sky Sports News. It was a very strange sort of transition for me because I never really wanted to be a television presenter as such. I never really thought about it. And all of a sudden I was one. And I worked with a guy called Andy Kenz, a bit like Andy Melvin, who I also worked with briefly, although he wasn't too much of a fan, I don't think.
Well, he wouldn't be slow to let you know what he thought, that's for sure.
If he wasn't too much of a fan, you knew about it. Kenzie was brilliant with me. He was brutal, and I respond to that. I don't, you know, I was in the industry when I was like very young. I sort of responded to him sort of being quite stern with me and telling me to do this and do that and don't do this and cut that out and get rid of that. I remember once me and Ed Chamberlain did a segment on something on Sky Sports News, and we'd started laughing halfway through, and he came in the next morning and we were savaged. We didn't do it again, that's for sure. But, you know, all those people, you know, I think working at Sky, I learned so much. I mean, Gary Hughes, who's now the executive editor of football, was my producer on Sky Sports News. I mean, he's a terrific, a very inventive, creative guy. Kenzie the same, you know, a journalist, a proper old school journalist who worked in a proper old school newsroom, and he demanded that everybody had those journalistic capabilities. So all those people, I think, that you work with over the course of 20 years, I mean, people think that, you know, you turn up, all of a sudden you just turned up and you're doing England games on ITV. Actually, you know, it's taken a very long time to even get a chance to do something like that. And Dan will tell you the same, I think. You know, but you learn along the way, and you need that grounding. I think that grounding is the most important thing that ever happens to any of us, that we work for a long time to get to a level. Because when you get to, I'm not saying that we've achieved anything yet, because both of us, I think, feel as if we want to do more, and we're never ever satisfied with what we've done. I mean, Dan and I have sat on the rattler, as we call it, at 11 o'clock back from London with a couple of bottles of wine, talking about how we missed this opportunity or that opportunity in a game or whatever, or standing on a sideline saying the same sort of thing. I think it's really important to have a body of work behind you before you get exposed.
That's true. And I'm definitely going to have to get Tom Ross on this podcast sooner rather than later, because I mention him pretty much every episode, because he was my mentor and he was the one that was brutal with me in my early days, and what he preached was very, very important, in the same way that you would have heard from Clive, Sam, or you would have heard from Andy, Dan up at Sky, whatever it was. You had to make sure you were listening, because if you made the same mistake twice in this industry, as in any walk of life, you were on borrowed time. You just had to make sure you soaked everything up like the proverbial sponge, because this is a very competitive business that we're in. There's a lot of people who, as Clive said to me last week on the show, they think they can do our job. Whether they can or not is almost irrelevant.
I think we're really lucky that we got a good group of young commentators coming through. I was really lucky in my role at Portsmouth to have come through and working with me, Dan Windle, who works at Talk Sport now. I had Chris Wise, who's now doing Match of the Day and IMG. I had John Beck, who's at IMG. I had Alex Crook, who is doing talk sports stuff and other bits and pieces as well. So I think there's a lot of people now that want to get involved in it. They were lucky enough that there were still the local radio jobs to be able to do the games all those years ago. And they've been at it, and they come across to the young people now, but they've been doing it for 20 years now or 15 years now, because those radio stations were around. The one thing that worries me now is that there's not those radio stations around.
No, when you look at Portsmouth, for example, you look at Express FM down there, and I know Jake and Ryan and Liam down there, who, you know, have got such passion for that particular club, but there's a limited amount that they can actually do. But you can still see the love that they have for radio and the medium. It's just that the power isn't quite there that they have, that they can wield in the way that you would have had at the Key, for example.
Yeah, it was a different world then. I mean, you know, you talk about the sort of rivalries between commercial radio stations. We actually took it, the rights from the Capital Gold Group. As that Capital Gold Group was sort of fragmenting, we took it from Ocean and we took it from them. And that was a big thing at the time. But our whole radio station was built around Portsmouth Football Club. The station only survived because of that. And when I left, I mean, I left to go to Sky, the football club bought the radio station, one of its many terrible transactions. Because not only did it then buy the radio station, when it collapsed, the football club, the radio station collapsed as well. It was an absolute mess, a real mess.
One of the great things about your time as a broadcaster, Sam, is some of the huge personalities you've worked with. We've mentioned Stan Collymore in passing, who I love dearly, and I've worked with him on games just like you have, but you've worked on far more commentaries with Stan than I did. But
longest relationship I've ever had.
Yeah, but Mickey Quinn, a man
on
of
and off the pitch.
A man of mischief, Mickey Quinn, was your oppo at the Key. Never a dull moment with Quinny, is there?
Oh, damn well, no, Mickey. I mean, big Scouse accent, big personality, loved Liverpool Football Club, but very much, you know, associated with Portsmouth and with TalkSport. He was fantastic company. Another great friend of mine. We don't see each other as much as we should. Stan, you've mentioned Piercy. Fantastic. Clark Carlisle, worked with him for ages. I'm now forming a new relationship with Dicko, which we probably, it's been going on for quite a while. Andy Townsend and I did a few games, well, few years actually working together on different matches. And then one guy who maybe not many people will have heard do live commentaries, but I spent 3 or 4 years with, was Alan McLaughlin, a former Republic of Ireland international, after Mickey Quinn left to go to TalkSport. Actually, I was still down on the South Coast and I worked with Alan. And Alan was a footballer, a proper footballer. And he would bring the dressing room. I mean, you know, he would bring the dressing room to a two young lads that were touring the country with him. He would very much be the footballer in the room. And he was very sort of like, you know, he was the alpha male. He was a great character, full of personality, full of great stories. He had a great tactical insight. He was just good company. He was a good bloke. And sadly, in the last year, he's passed away. And I must admit, you know, I think Dan mentioned earlier about a colleague of his that passed away early. When that happens to someone that you know and you spent a lot of time with, it is a sobering thought. It really is. And we've all had our touches with problems. But, I mean, you know, losing Alan at such a young age was incredibly distressing for his family, for his daughters, for the industry as well, and for football, because football lost a very good coach there. That he, you know, and that's the other thing. You know, we form loads of relationships with loads of different people, don't we, up and down the country over the course of our careers. I mean, I think relationships at home suffer as a result of that, but, you know, because we're always on the road. But, you know, that's part of the business. And you say you wouldn't have it any other way. Obviously, if you could have everything, you would, but you can't. And we've got football, and that is a massive bonus.
It is. Yeah. I've had relationships that have suffered and a marriage that has suffered because of this job and what it entails and what it therefore denies you the opportunity to do. But eyes wide open. That's what you signed the contract for in a sense. And the outgrowth of that can sometimes work for you and sometimes work against you. But that's just the way it is. There's the way it ought to be, and there's the way it is. But with Dan, with you, you formed some strong partnerships on Sky with the likes of Don Goodman and Andy Hinchcliffe over the years, because they're kind of regular partners for you, aren't they?
Yeah, I've been working with Andy going back to the radio days, actually. I used to fill in and do the odd commentary on Manchester City when I was still at Radio City in Liverpool, because, again, another radio group. So I would go and fill in there. So I've got a relationship with him, broadcasting, going back more than the 15 years. Don as well. Danny Higginbotham, I had a great rapport with when he was doing Sky, and he's gone to a new challenge in the United States. But, you know, it was one of those where you kind of felt that you would get in the car. We would travel to the games together, me, Andy, and me and Danny. And you wouldn't, basically, it would just continue on air. It would be the same sort of conversation, a few changes to the vocab at some points. But that would be it. And you would take that into the game. And I think that was quite quite good in terms of, you know, the viewers feeling that warmth, I think. And I had some good relationships in the early days on radio as well. I mean, I worked with some of my co-commentators, Tommy Smith, I worked with, no nonsense there. But he was great. He was a really gentle soul in a lot of ways, Tommy. Not that you might think that, but he was quite sensitive and very, very kind and very helpful. And I did a few games with him. Ian St. John, I worked with a lot, which, I mean, reflecting on his passing, and now Jimmy Greaves has obviously gone as well. A whole part of our childhood has kind of gone. But I remember being this snotty-nosed kid telling Ian St. John what to do as a producer. And sometimes you get, why are we doing that, son? And you'd explain, and he would go, right. And he'd do it. But I worked with him as a commentator as well, and I really enjoyed that. That was a real dream come true, because he was one of the voices that you heard sort of week in, week out. And I did a number of games with Saint, and he was always really sharp. He was always really on it, and I loved working with him. And he, again, was very helpful, because he knew all there was to know about, not necessarily from a commentator's point of view, but the world of television and what it can be like. And he gave me some great advice on that score, which has proved fairly useful.
Now, you mentioned Danny Higginbotham there, who's known to all of us. I love him loads. He is, as you say, over in America now, working as a broadcaster over there. But he is responsible, as far as I'm concerned, I could be wrong, for the introduction of the heated gilet to the press.
He is to blame. He
totally is.
And we've now moved on to heated socks, yep. Heated foot pads, and all sorts. When it comes to gadgets and gizmos, Sam Matterface, I have to say, you lead the way. You lead and others follow, because you were talking about the handwritten notes that were lost to you at Anfield that floated down to Brian Kidd.
They went a long time ago.
Your methods are so much more advanced than mine will ever be. And I have to tip my hat to you for that, because you utilise apps and pads and iPads and whatever in a really, really clever and, I would imagine, time-saving way.
I'm a saddo. The truth is that I think I exposed myself by saying that I spent most of my evenings and weekends at a hospital radio station when I was 14, 15 and 16, when everybody else was having a lot more fun. And I love technology. I love playing, and I change the way I do things and prepare, because I'm interested in experimenting and changing, using different technologies. I'm just into it. That's what I do. Some people gamble, some people drink, some people have got a sex addiction. I just like computers and technology.
I'm the same. I mean, I'm very much an iPad man in terms of my preparation. I mean, it's all still handwritten, but you can get an app for that now, and it's great. And I gravitated from laminated card to the iPad some time ago. So yeah, I love all that as well. Yeah, I think technology, you know, it has to serve a purpose, and I think I've certainly changed the way I do things to adapt to the technologies that are around. It's great.
It was interesting what Dan said earlier, though. You know, the process of making the notes and doing the preparation is not actually to have it in front of you when you're in the game. It's to put it in your brain. When some people ask me about preparation, I have got loads of notes with me. I don't use any of it. In fact, it's more likely that I will use it afterwards when someone asks me a question about something, and I'll go, oh, hold on a second, and I'll flick back through the book to have a look at where someone played or how many goals they got or whatever. Because when I'm in the moment, most of that stuff will come because it's an exam. I see it like I do my revision before I go, and then when I get on air, that's the examination. And yeah, I suppose it is about getting it in your head.
I think what it also does, the prep, I mean, I sometimes think it's not so much what you've found out or what you've looked at, but from my point of view, and I'm talking about purely psychologically going into a commentary, is if you're well prepared, how do you feel?
Yeah.
And you feel ready in a way that if you've been scrambling around and rushing, you don't. So it's not necessarily the content, it's the psychology of doing it in a way that is the big benefit, certainly for me. Yeah, absolutely.
I just enjoy the process. Just the fact that sitting down and looking stuff up and making sure that you know what you think you know. And then, as you say, you might discover a little nugget of information that, oh, that's great. I may or may not get an opportunity to use that, but it's so nice to know it. And I just enjoy the process. I am still a Luddite. I am still way behind you guys. I am still paper and pen.
Yeah, but that works for you. And, you know, you speak to Martin, you speak to Ian Dark, you speak to Clive. I mean, look at what Clive does. You know, everybody does it in their own way, which works and benefits them.
But it as long as you're happy with the process, and as you say, Dan, once that process is completed, you feel, okay, I'm ready for whatever this game might throw at me, then that's all you can ask at that point. And then you've got the complete chaos theory of the game itself, which can throw anything at you. Like Aguero, that you and Stan had to deal with back in, what was that, 2012 now, 2013? I can't remember the year now.
Yeah, we try and keep away from that. That's the worst bit of commentary I've ever done in my life.
Oh, Sam, come on now.
Oh, come on. It was absolutely brutally awful. And it was so bad. It was so bad. And, you know, we talked about people you formed. I think Dan said, you know, working with Saint was fantastic for him because it was an icon of television. I worked with, for a year and a half, 2 years, I worked on the Champions League with Richard Keys and Andy Gray. Culminating in the Champions League final in Munich in 2012. And, like, you know, in terms of teaching, learning experiences and, you know, working with big person, fantastic. Absolutely. Those guys treated me wonderfully and taught me so very, very much. But Richard did walk into the office the day after I'd done that Aguero commentary and just said to me, what did you think of your commentary yesterday on the big moment? And I went, I thought it was rubbish. And he went, correct, don't do it again. And that was the end of the conversation. And he was right.
Well, there you go, folks. Again, that's the brutal nature of this business. People do not mince their words.
Yeah, that's how Sky used to work. I mean, I got a couple of emails from Andy Melvin. There were no niceties. It just started with the words, don't ever. And... Yeah, that was kind of it. I remember getting one after I'd done a game at Darlington, funnily enough. I got this email. Don't ever say thank you to presenters and good evening to viewers. If I want Martin Tyler, I can get him.
This sounds remarkably like Richard Park. There must be something in the water up there on the border that produces the radio sound.
To be fair to him, it did say afterwards, thank you and well done.
Brilliant.
Also, brilliant. Carrot and stick, eh?
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, Sam, take me back. It's not too long ago, to the night before your first England commentary for ITV, because you're taking up the mantle that Hugh Johns and Brian Moore and Clive Tildesley have carried for so many years for independent television. How were your nerves the night before?
Yeah, I don't think I was very good to be around for about 10 days before, actually. And it was only when a friend of mine, we were in a WhatsApp group, said to me, the England game's coming up. when I sort of probably realized that that was the reason that I was having, I was being a bit sort of not grouchy, but just not the best sort of, I was just a bit sort of on edge. I suppose on edge is probably the right one thing to say. But I had a bit of a, I feel as if I had a bit of a false start really with the England stuff. In that, the first two live games I did were friendlies against teams that England absolutely battered with a B team with no supporters in the ground. And I also had my first ever live England game. No, that's not true because it wasn't, because I'd done one in the previous World Cup. But my first ever game of this tenure was a three-man booth. So I had me, Lee Dixon and Chris Coleman. And Chris Coleman's never worked with us before, and he'd only ever do it when that situation arises, which doesn't happen very often. But because it was a home nation, we had to do that. So it was a sort of difficult start, really. And then I had six highlights games over the course of that period as well. So it took a while to sort of get into it. I actually didn't feel as if I'd properly done an England commentary until Jakub Modder scored for Poland at Wembley. And I felt like I'd actually done a match, a real match, where England weren't just winning, because they were just winning. It was too easy. They weren't conceding any goals. There was no jeopardy in the games. There were not really contests. They were just processions. And it's very difficult when you're trying to make your mark and you're a new commentator. I wasn't a new commentator, actually. I've been there 10 years before I'd got that opportunity. But you know what I mean. It was difficult. I found it hard. The most nervous I was not that game. It was the England-Scotland game in the European Championships, where I had to take myself off to the gym at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I remember texting Robin Cowan, who was doing a Sweden game on the same day for the BBC, and saying, hearing you calm me down, because my mind was going in a completely different direction. I just needed to do something that wasn't thinking about England-Scotland. And luckily I got on the treadmill, I was watching that game that she was doing, and I just was like, okay, right, okay, just now shut up and get on with it and just do what you do. Yeah.
Have you had moments like that, Dan, before games? I mean, you do playoff finals, which are intense enough.
I think it's been a long time since I've really had massive nerves before a game. I think the worst one ever, I'm going to bring up St Andrews again, was a Monday night match between Birmingham and Wolves. Big game towards the end of the season. You're talking way back. It was McLeish and McCarthy were the two managers. And it was a big game for me. I hadn't done too many proper live games. And I remember being handed to by David Jones, and I was shaking. And it took a toll. Really didn't do myself justice that particular night, I don't think, although some of it was okay. But I haven't really felt enormous nerves. I mean, I've been lucky enough to do a World Cup final, a few Champions League finals. This was in the glory days of 3D, when I got to all kinds of places a young commentator at the stage of my career shouldn't have reached. And they were fantastic. But I don't know. I don't tend to get as het up anymore as I once did. I think sort of there's an element of, you get to a stage in your life where I certainly feel like there were times when I just tried too hard to impress. I was thinking about things other than the job in front of me. And I think that was important that I got away from that. So that's the only one occasion I can think of where I was really, really het up and anxious. But St Andrews, which I suppose is a common feeling when you've got to, trying to climb that ladder anyway.
We all feel like that though, don't we? Over the course of our careers, that basically every week that hasn't gone as well, we didn't do ourselves justice. But I think what you've just said is really important. One of the reasons that I was so nervous before the Scotland game is because I knew that I'd started with that Wales game, which was, I don't think it was very good. And I knew that the most important game that I was going to do, maybe I actually felt at the time, probably in my lifetime, a home tournament against Scotland, massive audience. We're in the middle of a pandemic, so there's even more eyeballs on it than there maybe would have been before. I felt as if I had to get that right. I had no choice. I had to get it right. And I had to get it right by doing what you just said, not thinking about everything else and not trying too hard. Because one of the problems I had, especially in the first few games, was that I did try too hard. I tried far too hard.
How does that manifest itself, Sam, for those listening?
I think you try to crowbar in information that you don't necessarily need to put into a game. Yeah. You know, I think so. I still wrestle with it. I come back and I look at the thing. And I think I didn't get that in. Yeah, but at the time it didn't warrant it. So if it doesn't warrant it, don't stick it in. And the same thing happened to me last night. I was doing a great game, and I didn't. I now feel comfortable. And Dan will know this. He just said, you know, you think you get to a point, and I'd got to that point in radio where I could let things go and not worry about it because I've been doing it for so long and I felt so comfortable with it. But in this, the new role that I took on, and, you know, I knew it was pressurized and I knew that it was a great opportunity and I'm very lucky to be doing it. I probably tried too hard for the first few matches. And now I'm still wrestling with it in my head, just trying to take your foot off the gas a little bit and not force feed people information, which one, either they might not care about, or two, is not relevant to what's happening at the moment. And that's where Clive last week on your podcast sort of pointed out something quite interesting. Really, you have to be very clever in television about when you put things in, because the audience have this one major advantage over the radio commentaries that they listen to. They can actually see what's going on, so you've got to make sure it's all relevant. And you are working, as he said last week, in a team. There's a team of people behind you that are dictating the flow of the game, not you.
We're running a little bit short time, gents, but there's a couple of questions I still want to put in. I get a lot of, I've had a few emails, not specific to you guys, but just emails I've had since I started the podcast from a couple of broadcast students and people like that. And one of the questions that I get asked a lot is about agency representation and how important it is or not. I've never had any agency representation. And I think I've heard the words conflict of interest more times than I care to remember when I approached an agency to ask whether they would be interested in taking me on. And by conflict of interest, I mean, no, sorry, son, we've already got somebody just like you. If we take you on, that means that compromises his or her work. Sam, I know you've got representation. Daniel, I don't know whether you have, but I don't know how important or unimportant you guys see having somebody representing you as being in this industry.
Well, I don't. I mean, I think there are some situations that it might help, but I've sort of got into every organisation I've wanted to without one. So from that point of view, it's certainly not necessary, but I think there are advantages to it, definitely. Yeah.
Those DVDs were your agent, basically, weren't they?
Yeah, the fact that I had access to a DVD burner, which back then was not that easy.
See, he's just as geeky as me.
Well, yeah, absolutely, turn it up to 11, yeah. And that served me very well. But just finding out who the right person to speak to or email by my own efforts has worked pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I mean, people might be surprised to say, well, the reason he's done all right is because he's got an agent, he probably needs one. But the fact of the matter is I didn't have one for a long time. Obviously, when I was younger, I didn't have one. My career started without one. I was in Portsmouth and I was a program controller. I was doing breakfast shows for different people and that was fine. And then I was nominated for an award. I won a commercial. I was nominated for Commercial Radio Presenter of the Year from Portsmouth, and that just alerted a couple of people to make a phone call. And they asked me if they could represent me. A guy called Andy Hipkiss and I chatted. I said, look, for me there was nothing. There was no negative in it because he was signing me to try and get me a better job. If he got me a better job, he'd get paid. If he didn't, then he wouldn't have done. And he took me to Sky Sports News. So I can't speak highly enough of the job that he did in doing that. We don't work together now. We worked together for 10 years. I've now got an agent, Joe Tung, who is, in my view, the best agent in the business. She is outstanding, and she's outstanding because she is a former radio producer, a content maker, and somebody who understands the business intrinsically. And what's great about having someone like that, even if it doesn't, even if Jo doesn't get you another job for, or she doesn't push you into where you, you know, in a certain direction, what she's great at, and she's good at all that stuff, by the way, is that I can pick up the phone to her and say to her, I've done this commentary, I really didn't like this. Did you hear this? What did you think of that? What did you think? She's my best mate. She'll talk to me through it. We'll discuss it. We'll have a, you know, I'm lucky enough. I've got good friends in the industry. Alex Crook, I've already mentioned, a very good friend of mine. We'll talk about radio. We'll talk about how it sounded and how it shaped. And she'll help me through that. And just crystallizing those thoughts. Sometimes she'll just say to me, yeah, I like this, but I didn't like that. And it makes me question it. And I, you know, I'm a nightmare. I listen to everything and go back and, you know, pick holes in everything because that's the only way to get better.
I would get far too depressed if I did that. So I've
sometimes I get really annoyed. I did a podcast the other night. I'm not joking with you. It's a true story. Sunday night, I did a podcast and I'd finished my show at 5 o'clock. I have to wait for Crookie to finish his show and we've got another guest, whatever. Recorded it, listened to it the next morning. And the first 10 minutes, I listened to it and I thought, you mouthy little git. Why did you keep speaking? Why did you say that? Why did you go in with that? Why did you bring this up? That should have been later. And I was so angry. I was on the train coming back to Manchester. And I got really wound up with myself because I felt I'd gone in too hard or I hadn't particularly phrased things the way I wanted to. So, but next time I know I won't do that because I've thought about it more carefully. So the process is helpful, but at the same time, you know, yeah, you do make yourself miserable. As a...
yeah.
It's much better if you do that when you're on the rattler at 11 o'clock.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, I want to hear more about this. You two sharing a bottle of...
It's gone. Have you noticed this, Dan? It's gone.
Well, I don't know. I haven't been getting the train for ages, so I've not paid attention.
Yeah, so because of the pandemic, there used to be this brilliant train. Because obviously we do off-tube stuff. Dan and I, IMG, we've done stuff at, we're doing Gravity, we do it at, so sometimes we're not doing TalkSport games or Sky games, we're doing games for other broadcasters or whatever around the world. So we're doing off-tube commentaries at Gravity or we're doing them at IMG. And we would get the 11, because we both live in the north, there's an 11 o'clock train from London Euston. It does not get you in into Manchester Piccadilly until 2 a.m. in the morning, right? But you wake up in your own bed the next morning and you can be at home. And for 1 second, your family recognise that you actually still live there. So it was always a great sort of train to get after an off-tube commentary. The problem is because of the pandemic, the new train company have taken it away. We used to sit on that for 3 hours with chat, have a bottle of red wine. It was fantastic. It's like being in the bar.
Absolutely, yeah. And no, it's sad that it's gone. I hadn't noticed that because I've not been doing as much as a... usually do in the last couple of years. So no, I hadn't noticed that.
I did get a similar train back to Birmingham International when I lived in Brum from Euston. It was again probably about 11 o'clock, maybe a little bit before that if I finished a Talk Sports show at 10 o'clock. But it was the lingering smell of Burger King pervading.
That's still there.
That's my
still there. Here.
That's going nowhere, that one.
That's sticking around forever, that one.
Look, we're almost out of time, gents. We've had a brilliant hour. I've not even got to Dancing on Ice, Sam. I've not even got to commentating on celebrities doing triple salchos. Do you invent some of those phrases? Because there are some
all of them. They're all invented. They're all invented because no one actually calls them real names. There's no name for any of these moves. They don't have them. It's not like we are stepping on toes or not doing our research. I work with Jane and Chris and they'll just say, well, that hasn't got a name. Or they'll call it this. And then Karen Barber, who, you know, obviously is a very famous ice skater as well in her own right and now a coach, she will say, no, we call it this. Well, what do you want to call it? So they'll give me a note. We'll go through it and they'll give me the names of them. And then, you know, also it's for a certain audience. So they want to sort of glam it up as well.
Yeah.
You say commentate. I say it's a voiceover gig, really, to be honest with you, because it's not really, well, unless someone falls over, it's not really commentate. But look, do you know what? The way it came about was, and that is another, a story for another day. It was complete luck, you know, like everything in life, it's all luck. And I did not want to do it. I felt as if I was sort of forced into it, but What a fantastic experience. What a fantastic experience it's been. And it's been great because I've met people I never thought I'd meet. And, you know, it's a different type of tech. And Dan will tell you, the geeky side of it is great because it's completely different. And the way that light entertainment make television programs is different to the way sport makes TV programs. So it's just nice to be able to see the different ways people make things as well. So the geek in me loves it. And the Sunday night bar is fantastic.
I'm pleased that the estate of Alan Weeks isn't going to be upset about, you know, the butterfly wheel lift or something would sort of tread on his toes from, I don't know, Robin Cousins in 1980 or something. Have you had any weird or unusual commentary gigs, Dan, that can go anywhere near matching Sam doing Dancing on Ice?
Not really. I tried to commentate on powerboat racing on the radio once, which was quite difficult because they're about 300 yards away.
Where was
that was in Liverpool. They had an event. I can't even remember the competition now, but they had an event in the dock area in Liverpool. And I was sent down to try and describe what was going on into the morning show. And that was a complete and utter disaster. Thankfully, the line went down and we couldn't get it back up, which probably saved me. I came very close to commentating on some luge once for Eurosport when a guy was stuck in traffic and I'd been in doing some football, but happily he came panting through the door with about 5 minutes to go and was able to bail me out. But I've stuck not actually necessarily through choice, but I've stuck pretty strictly to football.
Don't say strictly.
Yeah. Oh, the mortal enemy. It would have to come up. Listen, Sam, Dan, what an absolute pleasure it's been chatting to you both about this strange old world that we all inhabit. What plans have you got for the next few days, Dan? Have you got some Championship or EFL work coming up, or Premier League, or what?
I am brushing up on Reading and Middlesbrough.
Okie dokie. Sam, of course, you've got a very big game for TalkSport Saturday lunchtime, haven't you?
I've got two massive games in 4 days for TalkSport, and they're both involving Manchester City. So Chelsea, Manchester City on Saturday, and then PSG, Manchester City on Tuesday. So, yeah, massive, massive matches. And, you know, I love the Champions League. I love the Champions League. And I can't wait to see that. I don't think we're going to see Messi, unfortunately, but... yeah, it's going to be great. And what a great title race we've got. So we look forward to it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I've got the joys of Everton-Norwich on Saturday.
That'll be a good game, that. That'll be a good game.
I've seen a lot of people writing Norwich off, which I think is it's an interesting debate. But we're 5 games into the season. And as I put on Twitter this morning, the clocks haven't even gone back yet. So I'm happy to reserve judgment on how good or bad their season's going to be until I've seen at least a few more games. But I think they did start better 2 years ago and whatnot. I think I've got a bit of Champions League. I might be seeing you in the studio next week. I'm doing Porto-Liverpool, I think.
Oh, which... same night as me, yeah.
Yeah, so...
Oh, I'm staying down afterwards and I'm not getting the rattler, so we can go across the road.
There we go. That's a date. I'll have some of that. Sam Matterface, thank you very much. Most kind of you to come on. And Daniel Mann as well, thank you for being part of the Commentator's Curse. Thanks, guys. It's been a blast.
It's been pleasure. Lovely to be here. Thank you.
So the archive of episodes is there for you to listen to at your leisure of the Commentator's Curse. We're now up to 6 episodes. Episode 7 is going to be just around the corner. Rate, review, subscribe, all that malarkey. My thanks once again to Sam Matterface and Daniel Mann. This is Ian Danter signing off. Thank you for listening to the Commentator's Curse.